The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email if you end up using any content. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina 28816. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.
This week, William spoke with Jill McCracken, co-director of SWAP Behind Bars for the Sex Worker Outreach Project, Behind Bars Chapter. Jill is also a professor at the University of South Florida at St. Petersburg, teaching rhetoric and gender and sexuality studies with a focus on sex work, prostitution, and trafficking in the sex industry. For the hour, we'll hear Jill speak about that work that SWAP and SWAP Behind Bars does, FOSTA SESTA, and some of the realities faced or worked through by sex workers in the U.S. The mission statement for SWAP Behind Bars reads, quote, SWAP Behind Bars is a national social justice network dedicated to the fundamental human rights of people who face discrimination from the criminal justice system due to the stigma associated with the sex trade. We advocate for full decriminalization of consensual sex work, ending cash bail, drawing attention to the effects of generational poverty on sexualized violence against marginalized and vulnerable women, while providing services and support with a focus on ending violence and stigma through education and advocacy. More about SWAP Behind Bars can be found at swapbehindbars.org, or more about SWAP in the U.S. in general can be found at swapusa, that's swopusa.org, with other groupings findable online. For a slightly longer version of this interview, please check out our podcast version of the episode up at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org or via the iTunes store, subscribable for free there. That'll also be the version that's up on SoundCloud for a little bit, available at YouTube and other platforms. More info at our website. But before we bring you this interview, we have a few announcements. First, a reminder that Blue Ridge ABC has a plethora of events coming up this weekend in Asheville, starting at 6 p.m. sharp on Friday, February 1st at Firestorm, with a showing of Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal, about the prisoner, his writings, and struggle for freedom. Then at 8 p.m., Witch Game Coven will present a showcase of local talent from their crew and beyond at the Mothlight. Local hip-hop and beats, you know? It's a benefit for Blue Ridge ABC, so come and visit the table. And on Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. at Firestorm, Blue Ridge ABC will host its monthly Political Prisoner Letter Writing Night. If you've got the means to travel on Saturday, February 2nd, there is a call for people to oppose white nationalists at Stone Mountain in Georgia and the racists' attempt to rally there. They don't have a permit and are pissed that they keep losing their racist monuments around the South. Boo-hoo. For those opposing, we interviewed an organizer with Frontline Organization Working to End Racism, or FLOWER, by its tortured acronym, about what it's all about and what to expect. You can hear about that on our January 13th episode. Jason Renard Walker is a prisoner who was transferred on January 11th to the All Red Unit, and his supporters are very concerned about his welfare and the health of Mr. Walker. He reports being denied his prescribed medications, being forced to stand outside in the rain, being denied basic necessities of blankets, sheets, toilet paper, soap, etc., being served food that he is allergic to, being denied requested medical services. All these abuses must be corrected immediately. You can find out more about how to support Jason at the itsgoingdown.org article entitled Abuse at the All Red Unit, and All Red is A-L-L-R-E-D. We are also a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts. Here is a jingle from a member of that network.
How can we imagine a world beyond prisons and police, borders and surveillance?
Rust Belt Abolition Radio is an abolitionist media and movement building project based in Detroit, Michigan.
Each monthly episode amplifies the voices of those impacted by mass incarceration and explores ongoing work in the movement to abolish the carceral state and racial capitalism.
Tune in to Rust Belt Abolition Radio here on the Channel Zero Network and visit www.rustbeltradio.org to learn more.
One last thing before we share William's chat with Jill McCracken.
I'm back.
What you say, what you say, what you say, what? We're cool like a boss!
And I'm also back at the Super Duper Max, where my radio career first began, where it first discovered me and realized I had a face for radio. I've been on vacation for a few months, but not the kind the burst went on. You know, gallivanting all across Europe with that ridiculous duct tape Sean Swain blow-up doll he was lugging around at soccer games. Now, my vacation occurred in the Warren Correctional Seg Unit after haters of the fart goblin variety found an article at June11.org that advocated using drones to drop guns into the prisons. I don't know, but if it got me 6 months in Seg followed by transfer to the Super Duper Max, it must be worth reading. I know you guys missed me. Without me on the final straw, there's just no designated time for a decent bathroom break. So, while I was locked away in SAG, I tried to keep up with what was going on with you dumpster-burning, cop-car-tipping, Molotov-throwing, ski-mask-wearing, machete-wielding, savage cannibal maniacs out there. And I must say that some of the report packs were very discouraging. I'm somewhat disappointed if the information is true. I heard some of you started a stamp club. A stamp club? A few of you began playing cribbage. Who plays cribbage? And this is unconfirmed, but someone told me that in my extended absence, one final straw listener went out and obtained gainful employment. A job. A paying job. That's totally unacceptable. I don't know, but if this was a reality show, I think that could get you voted off the island. Anyway, I'm back. So trash the stamps, burn the cards, quit the job. We've got important work to do. The hierarch delusion is not going to topple itself. There are fire alarms to pull, banks to rob, computer systems to hack, highways to block, corporate managers to kneecap, and bowling balls to launch from potato guns. Not because it's effective, just because it's fun. Remember, almost only counts in horseshoes, hand grenades, charts, darts, nuclear bombs, and bowling balls launched from potato guns. I tell you what, it feels good to have my insurrectionary street cred back, having the fart goblin high command recognizing my incredible danger and influence among the dumpster fire demographic. It appears as though the oppressive dimwits of retribution and corruption, the ODRC, hold me personally responsible for the entire internet. Yeah, I'm bigger than Al Gore. Suck it, Al. According to the conduct report issued against me, the fart goblins found the guns and drones article at June11.org and automatically blamed your favorite anarchist prisoner. The conduct report points out that I'm an anarchist, as it is apparently okay these days in America to imply guilt based on ideology. And it said I directed my instructions to my followers. You know, because anarchists are famous for our leaders and followers. Yeah, I know. The conduct report was written by Trevor Clark, an ODRC lawyer who has terrorized and tormented me for years. He claims to be doing it for the FBI. Though the FBI won't write me back when I ask them if it's true. I think when they get mail from me, they hide under their desks and close their eyes and try to summon their spirit animals. So I don't know. I may have to find a way to take them down, too. Anyway, Trevor Clark, the architect of this goofiness, I wrote an affidavit on November 7th describing how Clark groped me and made humiliating sexual demands of me in 2013. And within 2 weeks of my affidavit, Clark no longer worked at the ODRC. You can read about my allegations of his predatory behavior at itsgoingdown.org. But that's not the only turd that got flushed. Director Deary Moore, the monster who introduced domestic torture into Ohio prisons, resigned. He has now moved to North Carolina. I guess Ohio human rights criminals moved to North Carolina, sort of like Nazi war criminals left Germany and snuck off to Bolivia. Maybe Gary can pick up the final straw from wherever he lives. Hey, Gary, haven't forgotten about you. So, anyway, based on the conduct report about internet postings, I went to the serious misconduct panel, where a jackass deputy warden named Doug Lunicky called me an arnicist. Yeah, arnicist. Then he and Deputy Warden Marva Allen found me guilty of rioting, gang activity, and extortion, making me probably the single most dangerous prisoner in Ohio penal history. Based on that, Deary Moore tried to get me transferred out of state, you know, before he fled to North Carolina to avoid my arnicus wrath. He asked the feds to place me at Guantanamo Bay, but they refused. They said they don't need my kind of disruption there. The ODRC vigorously shot for some other state to take me, but I was categorically refused by all 58 other states and the District of Columbia, twice. I went on a hunger strike for 29 days back in September. Lost almost 70 pounds. I got nothing. Until early January, I was slated for transfer to the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville, until I exposed the plot hatched by Lucasville employees to murder me in a staged suicide. No kidding. The information came from prisoners inside the prison, who wrote to warn me of my imminent assassination. So, I arrived here, the Super Duper Max, where my radio career began. I'm still breathing, still got a pulse, and I'm still fighting mad. Here's the thing. Postings online are regulated by the FBI and the FCC, not the Ohio prison system. So in a sneaky, underhanded way, fart goblin prison officials have used their prison rules and disciplinary process to essentially regulate the internet, to control public forums, to stifle political discourse, holding me responsible for anything that appears online that they don't like. That means I can never get out of prison until I can find a way to make the 4 billion internet users refrain from bad behavior. It also means that whenever an arnicist posts anything out there, the fart goblins might just kick the hostage in here. A strategy to silence not just me, but all arnicists. This is selective and invidious. No other Ohio prisoner has been treated like this. Activist lawyer Pam Starcy is attempting to help me out, and anyone with big piles of loot can donate with the PayPal button at SeanSwain.org. It will likely take 10 to 20 grand to get rolling. Also, there's a petition you can find through itsgoingdown.org and elsewhere, pledging to boycott Ohio until I get justice. This is important because tourism and academics and transport are three of Ohio's top five industries. Be sure to sign on and share that petition with 10,000 of your closest friends. I think a few million people already signed. Well, at least 6 people, including my mom. I gotta get home someday, and that may require fostering Ohio's economic collapse. So, help me out here. Cribbage? Stamp clubs? Really? This is Arnicist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio's Super Duper Max in Youngstown, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new/old address at Sean Swain, number 243-205, Ohio State Penitentiary, 878 Coitsville Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read more of Sean's writings and keep up on his case, visit SeanSwain.org.
Would you just introduce yourself and tell listeners a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. So my name's Jill McCracken, and I am the co-founder and co-director of SWAT Behind Bars. And SWAT stands for the Sex Workers Outreach Project. So we're the Sex Workers Outreach Project Behind Bars. Mm-hmm. And I also am a professor. I teach at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. And I teach rhetoric and critical thinking analysis, and I do a lot with women's and gender studies, gender and sexuality studies. So that's kind of my area. I've been researching sex work, prostitution, and trafficking in the sex industry for about 14 years now. And so that's my primary area of research.
That's really cool. How did you get into working with SWAP?
Oh, that's good. Good story. I was actually in Tucson, Arizona, of all places. Well, I was getting my degree in Tucson and at the University of Arizona. And they had a very vibrant sex worker rights movement. And I was beginning my dissertation research, and I knew that I wanted to look at something that related to sex, sexuality, and bodies, and also violence and choice and agency. And one of the things that I thought was, well, and at that time, that was, gosh, when was that? 2004. At that time, you know, trafficking, the concept of trafficking in the sex industry was really getting more hyped up. It still is. And so that was one thing that I was thinking about. But then I said, no, I really want to work with street-based sex workers to try to get a better understanding of what is going on in terms of all of these different things, choice, agency, whatever. And so I started kind of learning more about the sex worker rights movement. And I connected with Robin Pugh, who was the founder, one of the co-founders of SWAP, Sex Workers Outreach Project, and here in the U.S. Anyway, I met Robin Pugh, and she wanted to start this organization. She actually borrowed the name, if you will, from Australia. So there's a SWAP that was originally created in Australia, and she borrowed it, asked them if we could use it, and they said, yes, definitely. And we wanted to create a 501c3, a nonprofit, and she asked me if I would be willing to be on their nonprofit. And at this point, I had known her a few years, and one of the problems with it was that for a 501c3, you need your legal name. And there were just so few sex workers who were willing to put their legal name on the paperwork. And I said, I don't care. I'm a professor, and I would love to. And I actually did a lot of accounting, so I was treasurer. So I was on their founding board, the national organization's founding board, and I was on that for quite a long time, probably like 5 years, I think. And then, and I've always been a member. We have so SWAP is a national organization, and then we have chapters all over the country. And so when I was living in Tucson, I was part of SWAP Tucson. When I first moved to Florida, we really didn't have much, so we called ourselves SWAP East because we had somebody in North Carolina and someone in Florida. And then now we have SWAP Tampa Bay, which is great, and we have SWAP Orlando, and then we have SWAP Behind Bars, which is not really connected to any state. It's directly related to people who are incarcerated.
That's really amazing. That's like, it's cool to hear the progression of how SWAP kind of spread out in the U.S. And I think that we have a newly formed SWAP Asheville as well.
Nice. I just heard the other day somebody said SWAP Hawaii.
Whoa.
Somebody in Hawaii was asking for SWAP Tampa Bay's materials. They liked it or something. And I was like, I didn't know we had a SWAP Hawaii. That's awesome.
Really, really cool. So. It's really cool also to see how the sex workers' rights issue and issues stemming from the issues have like gained a little bit more visibility. And it's really heartening to see for me. I'm really curious about sort of what you see as the ties between this the SWAP activism or like SWAP work that you do and the work that you do in the university. Do you see any sort of like strong parallels there, or like has your work in one field informed the work that you do in another field?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's really important. So I teach language, and I teach English and critical thinking, and I teach writing. And a lot of people will look at me and say, why, you know, you should be an anthropologist or a sociologist or whatever. So one of the classes that I developed was the Rhetoric of Marginalized Communities. And it's an undergraduate class. And marginalized communities is very incredibly broad, you know, so it can engage with a lot of different audiences. But I will talk about with my students, I will talk about my work with SWAP Behind Bars. I will talk about my work with SWAP in general. I also have other organizations that I work with. I work with an organization that works with incarcerated women. It's not related to sex work at all, the Red Tent Women's Initiative. And so I'll talk about these things. I also sometimes teach grant writing. And so my students will do a grant writing project for organizations, a small grant writing project. But I bring these examples in, and then I teach a sex work and trafficking class in the Women's Studies Department at USF Tampa, and that's directly related, I mean, you know, in terms of what's going on. So I definitely see the connections, and I think that it's really important, even if I'm teaching a first-year comms position class, which I haven't taught in a long time, I certainly wouldn't require or make anyone do a lot of thinking about sex work or trafficking if that wasn't the theme. But I think that it can be really helpful for people to think about how these constructions are made, how constructions are made in language, because it's really incredibly powerful. That was the reason for my dissertation research initially, was to say, how does the language surrounding street-based sex work impact the material conditions of their lives? And that was the research question, was how does it relate to grant funding? How does it relate to resources? And so, again, I think language is incredibly powerful. And so no matter what class I'm in, I'm going to be giving examples. And I will talk very openly about the work or the projects that I do. And then oftentimes I'll have students who say, that's really cool, I want to volunteer or whatever. And so sometimes they'll volunteer with us and that kind of thing, which I think is...
That is really great. I really want to take that class now. I mean, that's a fascinating sort of like thought provocation, definitely. You've mentioned SWAP a bunch of times, the Sex Workers Outreach Project. Maybe this is a self-evident question, but what is this group's mission? And would you talk a little bit about like generally what it does?
Yes. So SWAP in general is an education and advocacy organization. So you can go, I don't have our mission statement, like I don't have it memorized, it's on our website. But what I would say from somebody who's on the ground is that what we care about is creating community for sex workers and creating safety and creating resources for sex workers. And so that can come through networking, that can come through all different kinds of things. We have an 800, we call it a warm line, it's not a hotline because we don't have it necessarily, you know, being answered 24/7. But one of the things that I love about SWAP is that there's the national level SWAP, and they have a board, and I haven't been affiliated with that board in quite some time. And then we have chapters. And basically, you can create a chapter, and you're basically agreeing to hold an event or do something for the four key days that we value for SWAP. And I can say more about that. And then basically, that's it. There's not a lot of dogma. It's basically, do you value what we value? Do you value sex workers? Do you think that sex work is work? We can't, like on our website, I'd be curious, I have to go back and look at it. We can't, as a 501c3, we cannot openly advocate for decriminalization. We can put it on our website and say we're in support of decrim. We can say that Amnesty International came out in 2015 in support of decrim, but we are not allowed to lobby and we are not allowed to spend a lot of money on decrim, right? So we definitely, I would say, are in favor of decriminalization because we feel like prostitution being illegal creates harms. There's just no doubt that it creates a lot of harm for a lot of people. And so really we're education and advocacy and community building, because I think sex workers often feel isolated. And so it's really helpful. And then what's nice about the individual chapters is like, so Chicago, this was years ago, but End Demand, which is connected to the Nordic model, or basically that we would arrest the people who are purchasing rather than, you know, and not arrest the people who are selling in demand. So that was a huge issue in Chicago. So Chicago started working on that. Whereas in Tucson, that wasn't our issue. So local SWAT chapters are doing whatever it is that they most need to do for the sex workers that are in their area.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind saying a few more words about sort of like the chronic isolation that some sex workers can feel.
Yeah, I think that because we live in an environment where it's criminalized, where prostitution is criminalized, even though many people in the sex worker rights movement are not doing illegal things, like, for instance, in porn or are camming or phone sex operator, or whatever it is, right? These things are not illegal. But what you will see with all of those things, except for porn, I guess, is that you're working on your own. You know, you're working on your own with your clients. And in the porn world, I know less about that. But, you know, you're working on your own. And so there's that. And that you can spend time in your house and then go see a client. And then you're at your house and go see a client or however you do it. Or if you're on the street, you may be working on or near the street. And then you can oftentimes feel isolated because you're seeing your clients, but you're not necessarily in a community. And oftentimes in the street, at least my experience has been, that there's a lot of competition. So you feel like you're competing. So that's isolating as well. But most significantly, I would say, aside from like your physical location and all of that, is oftentimes people are not, you know, quote unquote, out about the work that they do. And stigma and discrimination by far is one of the biggest issues that sex workers deal with. And that's very isolating. And especially if you feel like I can walk into any room pretty much, not all, but pretty much, and say, oh, yeah, I'm a professor. And you get this look like, oh, or there's some people who are like, ah, you ivory tower person. But, I certainly don't put my head down and say, I'm a professor. Sorry, I know it's not what people like. And a lot of sex workers, I think, feel like they can't walk into a room and proudly say, I'm a sex worker. There are many that do and can, but I think that's very isolating, and I think that's very, very lonely. And the shame that the culture brings to this is problematic and just places layer upon layer of isolation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for going into that and for your words on that. So we're here to talk about the Swap Behind Bars project that you mentioned, which is a chapter of the Sex Workers Outreach Project. Would you talk about this group and how it formed?
Yes. So Alex Andrews is my co-founder and co-director, and she actually, I'll have to give her the credit in terms of the brainchild of the operation. She does a lot of Twittering, tweeting. And I'm not a Twitter person. I mean, I do it a little bit, but it's just not really my thing. And she got into an argument with a guard at one of the prisons in Florida. And it was a Twitter argument. And I think they were talking about decriminalization, and he was like completely against decrim. And he's working with people who have been incarcerated for prostitution. And he's working with people who are potentially going to become victims of trafficking when they leave, which is a complicated story that I can talk more about. But he's directly engaged, and he's completely against decrim. And so Alex and he were engaging, and I think it was through that he finally kind of, his mind kind of came around after she made all of these different arguments. And his mind came around, and he said, you know, maybe we should partner. Maybe we could actually get you guys to come in to the prison, and who knows, maybe we could do some training or whatever. And none of that actually happened in terms of that situation because of a lot of different complicated things. But what did happen was Alex came to me and said, you know, and this has been an issue that SWAP has gotten pushback from a lot of different organizations, and rightly so, absolutely rightly so. SWAP has largely been, historically been, a white, middle-class, quote-unquote, whatever, sex workers group. because it takes resources to organize. It takes time. It usually takes a phone. It often takes a computer. And when you're living on or near the street, you don't have the time and energy to let's get together and let's talk about how we need to organize. Katie Simon, I will say, Katie Simon is amazing, and she's actually doing this right now with a group of street-based sex workers in, I want to say, Massachusetts. And she has a GoFundMe online where she asks people, she pays them to do the work. So they're coming together and figuring out what their issues are, and they get paid through this GoFundMe. That's ideal. It's often not sustainable, right? But it is, I mean, she may disagree with me on that because it's a GoFundMe. Okay. So people who are incarcerated are obviously, especially people who are incarcerated for prostitution, are obviously directly impacted by prostitution laws. And they are, their voices are not typically engaged in the sexual rights movement. And so we talked about it and we said, wow, look at all these people who are incarcerated for prostitution or prostitution-related crimes. And look at how, one, they don't even know, perhaps, that a sexual rights movement exists. But two, we are learning from them. We are learning what are the issues that we need to be addressing. What's going on, right? So it's a two-way street. And so we said, let's create a chapter that's SWAT behind bars. It started out primarily in Florida with Florida prisons, but it's all over the country. We have people in prisons, and they're primarily prisons rather than jails. I don't know. Well, you probably know the difference. There's a lot more turnover in jail. So we have people all over the country in prisons, and it's really evolved. It just started. We started in, I believe, May of 2016. We created a letter, a newsletter that said, you know, I think it was, what is sex work? And then we included the Amnesty International decision. I don't know how familiar you are with that, but in August of 2015, Amnesty International came out and said, we are in favor of decriminalization of all aspects of prostitution. We think that it's better for safety, and we think that it's better for health in terms of access to condoms and preventing HIV and other STIs. So that was a huge deal, and they got, Amnesty International got a lot of pushback on that. But we added that story to the newsletter, and basically just saying there's a community out here. There's a group of people out here. And we think that there's a lot of people, especially women, but I would say equal numbers of men and trans men and trans women, who engage in sex work or engage in exchanging sex for something of value, right? If you've been incarcerated, you have a record, you have a harder time making a living, and I don't want to, I'm struggling with my words right now because I don't want to put people in a box, but we think, and there are no statistics, but we think that a lot of people, especially who have engaged in street economies, and then they oftentimes are lower socioeconomic level, which is oftentimes the people that end up in prison. They can't get the good lawyers or whatever. So people that are in a lower socioeconomic and involved in street economies are perhaps more likely to engage in prostitution or exchanging sex. So we just wanted to reach out to that population to say, what do you think? Do you want to join our community, right? And we also knew that we could provide some resources if they were so desired. And so we started that way. That was basically how we started it.
Regarding, stumbling over your words about, recidivism. I think that there's a really complicated web of stigmas and institutional repressions that only get heightened with a criminal record. So yeah, thanks for going there in your answer.
We as human beings, as people, we engage in sexual relations for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I can go on Tinder and meet somebody, and I mean, who knows? Maybe I've Airbnb'd my house, and my girlfriend says you can't stay with me tonight. And I go on Tinder, and I'm like, find somebody, and I'm like, hey, let's go home, baby, and I spend the night with him because I don't have any place to go, and I'm not going to go buy a hotel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
no, that wasn't explicit. I'm going to have sex with you and you're going to let me sleep here. Mm-hmm. But this happens all the time in different ways, right?
Right.
And so, again, people that are engaged in street economies, oftentimes that's what that might look like as well.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. There are two questions that are occurring to me. We've like talked a bunch about, like the decriminalization of sex work, and SWAT Behind Bars is a group that advocates for full decriminalization. I was wondering if you would, just give some nuances for listeners between legalization and decriminalization.
Yes, absolutely. So, legalization is what exists in a few counties in Nevada, which is outside of Las Vegas. Some people have the idea that it's legal in Las Vegas. It is not. Certain counties, there are brothels, and this is also what we'll see in like Amsterdam and different places like that. And so it's legalized in the sense that the government has control over how it's offered and in what way. And so oftentimes what that does is it puts a lot of power in the government and in the people that are managing whatever it is, managing the brothel or managing, you know, whatever. It's less of an independent relationship, right? So legalization and it's taxed and all of that. And so that's legalized. And the reason why people... or many sex workers advocate for decrim is because the individual workers can choose to go to a brothel, but they are doing it on their own. They're independent contractors, right? That's what they would be. They would be independent contractors. That's not how it works typically. I don't know logistically how it works in Amsterdam, but I do know that there's oversight, and that's coming from the government. And with decrim, there's less of that. Right, which doesn't mean that it's a free-for-all, because there's other laws in place. You know, if you make over whatever, I think $600, you have to pay taxes on that. So there's tax fraud and there's, you know, whatever. So there's other laws in place that help to prevent problems with the individual person selling or purchasing, for that matter, right?
Yeah. Thank you. So
that's a nutshell. I keep thinking, I was in New Zealand for 3 months, and it's decriminalized. New Zealand is the only country in the world where it's been decriminalized.
That's really interesting.
And there is New South Wales in Australia, which is a state in Australia, it's decriminalized. But with New Zealand, it's entirely decriminalized, and they had the Prostitution Reform Act in 2003. Now, there still is legislature around that. One of the things that's fascinating is they say you have to wear a condom. In all sex work exchanges, you have to wear a condom. And there's a $2,000 fine if you don't, which puts a lot of the leverage on the sex worker, because if someone's pushing to not use a condom, the sex worker, the law is on the sex worker's side. It's like, I'm not going to pay $2,000 fine, right? So I don't want to get too far off in other countries, but... The individual, they are independent contractors. That's what they are. And so they're responsible whether they work independently, whether they work with a brothel, whether they work on the street. They're independent contractors, and they have to pay taxes, and they have to do all of what goes along with that. The other thing that's legislated is you cannot be under 18, and you cannot try to procure someone who's under 18, which, again, is directly related to, quote-unquote, trafficking. And yet they don't use that word, right? So it's interesting.
That is really interesting. You've spoken about like street-based economies versus otherwise, and I was wondering if you wouldn't mind like just giving a bare bones distinction of like street-based versus otherwise-based economies.
Okay, sure. Well, typically what I will say is that sex work in general is an umbrella term that includes legal and illegal activities. And I've already mentioned some of the legal are like pornography, camming, focus operator, dancing, erotic dancing. So illegal is prosecution. And so this can exist at all different kinds of levels, quote unquote. But typically, people work on or near the street. And so they work on or near the street. Or they may have a website that they have created themselves that they then people can look for. And there's like their what? Everything changed in April of last year with Sesta Fosta. And I know you're going to ask a question about that. So pre-Sesta Fosta, you know, people would either use Backpage where they would go and they would place an ad. And before 2011, they would use Craigslist, where they would place an ad and other people could find them and clients would know where to find them, right? And Backpage was the same way. Or they might have their own website. And that is then people would know through the erotic review board or whatever, all these different sites that they can find people and they get reviews and all of this. And that's less my primary area of research, so I'm not as educated in that. But I would say those are the different avenues through which people engage in prostitution.
Yeah, for sure.
Escorting, I guess, like the escort sites and all of that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was, just in case any listener was, like, unfamiliar with the terms. So let's maybe move on to Sesta Fosta, which is, you know, one of the hot-button topics regarding sex workers right now. How have you seen these bills impact the people that you work with? And what, in your opinion, can people do to maximize their safety and the safety of their friends and loved ones who are working?
Well, so we'll start with the first one. I mean, the impact has been, in many ways, it has been extensive, most especially right around the time when it first happened, because Backpage was seized, you know, a few days before Trump signed it into law. And so people just didn't know how to make a living, right? And I've heard from different people that the number of people that were working on the street just bloomed. Like, there were so many more people that were working on the street. That isn't still the case as much, but I think initially people were just like, well, how am I going to make my rent or how am I going to pay my bill? So that was that the direct impact, and I would say one is just, you know, finding clients and having a place where clients can find workers. But the other impact is safety. And the one thing that is really helpful, technology is challenging, but one thing that's really helpful about these online websites is that it creates a distance. It creates even like a phone. In the old days, you know, one of my friends, she's like, I remember we used to advertise in the Yellow Pages. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah, I remember those,
and,
too.
You know, even a phone, you have some distance. So you can negotiate what your terms are, which is really helpful. And you can also, you know, screen. And there's all different kinds of you know, what people call screening, and there's all different kinds of screening strategies that I'm not going to go into, but, you know, is this person, there's two reasons why people, in my mind, screen. One is because, are they tough? Am I going to get arrested, first and foremost? But two, am I going to get hurt? Is this some weirdo who's going to do something, right? And so with Sesta Fosta, We took those screens, right? It's online, fighting online sex trafficking. And it's very interesting because it's all focused on sex trafficking, right? Not labor trafficking, but sex trafficking. So we've taken those screens, we've taken that distance away in terms of having an online platform where people can then, you know, negotiate, talk, communicate, and figure out what is happening. And that, to me, is problematic because people are still wanting to work, so they're either going to go to the street or they're going to try to set up an independent website, or as what I've heard is there's all these other websites that are housed out of the country, right? And yet they're messy. They mix up information, and And so people are less, clients are less familiar, and maybe even clients are abusing it, and they are pushing sex workers to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. Many times people will very clearly put what they are open to doing and what they don't want to do. And so I think that part of the problem is everything has just shifted. It hasn't necessarily taken online communication away. It definitely took away a very central part of, for many people. And one of my friends and I were talking about this the other day, and she said that Seth the Foster basically took out the middle class sector. And so Magali Lerman, I'll make sure her name gets mentioned. Magali says, she basically says it's taken out the middle class of sex work. And I believe that. So the quote unquote higher, you know, and escorts, they still have their private pages and they're bringing in a lot more. And then of course we have street based sex workers, but the back page was like, you know, people can jump on and jump off. One thing is important to know is that all sex workers don't necessarily do that full time all the time. Right? They may do it here and there, jump in, jump out, whatever. So that's all gone. And I think it's made it much more dangerous for sex workers. And I think it's also put more power in the hands of what I would call managers or quote-unquote pimps. I don't like that word, pimps. Managers is often business-like. It puts more power in people because they can then say, well, I'll get you the dates. I'll figure out how to get you the dates. You put your faith in me and you give me this portion of money. And so there's a layer of exploitation that actually has been created because the independent operator may not be able to find the clients or operate independently as well. And I heard stories about that as well, that, you know, quote unquote pimps were maximizing on this, saying, oh, see, now we can use this to our advantage because you can't go out necessarily and have clients come directly to you.
Yeah, definitely. And like, sometimes it's like not really all that useful to talk about bills like these with what they, you know, what they purport to do versus what they're actually doing, because like with Sesta Fosta, there's like clearly an ulterior motive for the government. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I did hear it mentioned that these bills have not in any way impacted the like human traffickers that they are reportedly or purportedly going after, and in fact has like, you know, not in any way like affected the human trafficking scene.
Yeah, it's challenging because I was reading an article just a couple days ago, and you know, the FBI. And there's different, you know, there's different takes on this in the media. But, you know, the FBI would work with, used to work with Craigslist and now Backpage, or then Backpage, to try to locate. And they would actually compare missing children's faces with the faces in Backpage to try to see if it's happening, right? Well, that resource is gone. Yeah, it's gone. And, again, you know, many people will say, well, there's going to be less demand because people don't know how to find it. And, you know, you've taken away that platform. I think that what we've done in this, or what they have done with this legislation, is we have made it much harder to find victims of trafficking. And victims are already oftentimes not willing to come forward for lots of different reasons, right? Because prostitution is illegal, because they may be undocumented, you know, whatever the situation is. And one of the things that I think is really important to remember when we talk about sex work and trafficking in the sex industry, the two are very different things. And people have tried to conflate them again and again. I think there was one revamp of the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. The definition of trafficking is force, fraud, and coercion. You know, an act of prostitution under force, fraud, or coercion are when the individual is under the age of 18. They wanted to get rid of the force, fraud, and coercion and just be prostitution and under 18. All prostitution is trafficking. Well, if that happens, then basically now you're going after everyone. Everything is trafficking. So how do you know when somebody's consenting? So there's a a very distinct difference between trafficking in the sex industry, which requires exploitation, and, you know, prostitution, which is adults consenting to engage in sexual acts, right? And yet, what happens in the real world, we see this, and this is largely from my experience with SWAT Behind Bars. And this is largely from talking to people. You will see people who are in relationships with men. In the cases that I'm thinking of, they're in relationships with men, and these relationships can be very much consensual. Like, I'm selling sex, I'm a sex worker, and he's his thing, and we live together, and we're fine. And then they can become exploitative, where the man says, you better get out there and do this, because if you don't, blah, 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 right? And perhaps the opposite, but this is a domestic violence scenario that we're struggling with, and it's all wrapped up in prostitution. So a person can actually be a victim of trafficking and then choose to go out and be and sell sex by choice. And you can come in and out of it, but the resources and the recourse is not there because everyone is afraid of the police.
For real. I think that you made a really, really good point. And like, sex work is, I think, something that is so beset by and so plagued by, like, negative, you know, and you said this before in the interview, like negative media stereotypes, negative social stereotypes, and also just like a flattening of what doing sex work can mean. So like, yeah, thank you for giving that example, you know? And yeah, that, and I'm wondering too, like, since the Cyntoia Brown, verdict was just some, like, she just like got an appeal or like got her sentence commuted or something.
She was given clemency.
I'm wondering if you have any words on her situation and similar instances of like people who were trafficked.
Yeah, there was a really, really great article that I found through the Marshall Project, which I love the Marshall Project, where it talks about, you know, stand your ground laws only apply to certain people. And this case made it very clear that stand your ground laws do not apply to everyone. And if you happen to be a sex worker, if you happen to be a woman of color, then you're less likely to be believed or whatever it is. I mean, the fact that she was incarcerated for 15 years, that's a long time, you know? And I mean, that is crazy, especially given she being tried as an adult, given the circumstances around her. But she's, you know, was and is a young woman of color and was engaged in sex work. And, you know, and then you've got whatever. So I think that my words are that when you have a group of people who are criminalized, oftentimes they are not allowed the same human rights as people who are not criminalized. And they are often not taken as seriously. And it's just easier to say oftentimes, like, well, look, she killed him, you know, young juvenile delinquent, and she stole his money, or I don't remember all of the details. And then it just keeps going that way. And I remember a case, this was years ago, but I was furious because these two young women were dropped, just awful. They were dropped from a bridge and killed, and it was in Florida. And they were explaining that they had been bound and dropped, and they died. And they posted their mugshots, and they talked about that they were prostitutes. And to me, I was livid, because I'm like, one, why are you posting your mugshots? And two, why are you emphasizing, like, what? Because they may have engaged in sex work, that this is in some way connected, or it's less, you know, awful. I don't, you know what I'm saying? So I think that we in America, we have a tendency to other people. And when we other people, we don't give them the same rights. And we often maybe don't even think they deserve the same rights as those of us who may not choose that direction in our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe you can speak to, like, the frequency of, like, this kind of case, but I heard it said that there's, like, a lot of other cases, like Cyntoia Brown's out there that just, like, for whatever reason, haven't garnered the media attention. Do you have any, like, wisdom on that or words on that?
Yes. I mean, there's been quite a few. I mean, there's been a lot of cases where we've seen young, especially women, who have been incarcerated that, you know, there was one case where, and her name is not coming to my mind right now, where she was on Facebook and she was reaching out to another girl, quote unquote, grooming her because she was in a, what I would call an exploitative situation. And she was incarcerated because she was for trafficking. And we early on, SWAT Behind Bars got a package of letters from 8 women in Lowell Prison. And the 8 women had written their letters. I think an organization in California sent them to us because Lowell was in Florida. But they told us later that they had sent these letters to, like, organization after organization, you know, anti-trafficking organizations, all these different kinds, and nobody did anything. And what happened was they were telling their life stories. They were telling their life stories, and they were explaining, yes, we have all been convicted of trafficking, but look at what led up to this trafficking victim, right? I mean, look at what this led up to this trafficking sentence, right? And we just couldn't believe it. We couldn't believe that all these women's lives and how I, there's one who is a friend of mine now who, you know, she was absolutely choosing sex work. And then her boyfriend, you know, started pistol whipping her and another girl who was working with them and who was a minor. And so she took the rap for her boyfriend because she loved him. And she's now, you know, has a trafficking conviction and will be on the sex offender registry for the rest of her life. And we'll have a hard time finding place, a halfway house to go to when she leaves prison. And so these cases are not out of the ordinary. And we were lucky enough that I knew a lawyer up in New York, and we called that lawyer and we talked to them about the letters and shared them. And they actually have a team of lawyers working on these cases. And she says that my friend actually keeps sending more to her from people in this prison. And that's the problem with these trafficking charges and convictions. We want to get, we in terms of the United States, the Trafficking in Persons Report, you know, we base a lot on convictions, number of convictions. So we want to get these convictions. And yet what we're not doing is not looking at the messiness involved in what's happening. Let's just get everybody that we can. And so what she has done and her team has done, and she's actually gotten other people involved. I just talked to her yesterday. She said they filed, I think, 6 clemency files or whatever. I don't know what they're called. I'm not a lawyer, right? 6 of them. And I'm for some of these women, which is amazing. That's just amazing. Like, they got a team of lawyers to go in. She found some money and now they're doing these clemency requests. Now, who knows what will happen, but at least somebody's looking at this and saying, there's a problem here.
I think that the messiness involved in, like, how we think about all of this stuff, people's lived realities of, like, institutional racism and institutional violence, I think is really, really, really important to keep in mind when, like, nuancing our understanding of, like, sex worker realities and, like, survivors and victims of trafficking's realities as well. And maybe, like, to that point, I was reading your website and I was really impressed by the, like, mission statement and, like, what SWAT Behind Bars, like, says about the work that it does. And one of the passages was, quote, prostitution is one of the few crimes where women are arrested more frequently than men, but prostitution alone does not explain the growing numbers of Black, Latino, and trans women behind bars. Mm-hmm. Would you expand on this quote?
Yes. I don't have the numbers in front of me at all, but we do know that women are the fastest the fastest growing number of people who are incarcerated right now. In fact, I did do some research, and I'm working on a book, and I was actually looking to do some. And I think that the numbers of men have actually stabilized or even decreased, but for women, it's increasing. And that's significant problem. And I think, just like you talked about in terms of institutional racism and all of these intersectional issues, part of the problem is women are perhaps more at the forefront in terms of, well, for sure with prostitution, they're much more likely to be arrested. But also in terms of other things like drugs and selling drugs and all of that kind of stuff, they may be more at the forefront. And so that may be part of the reason for, in terms of those interactions or engagements in terms of the arrest. But I also just think that people are targeted more. And women of color, trans people, absolutely are targeted more. And there was a case similar to the one that we were talking about with Latoya Brown with Gigi. She's in New Jersey, and she's a trans woman of color. And she also had a difficult situation where a client was killed, and she is in prison. And, you know, she's in a male prison, and she can't get access to her hormones. And you know, there's that layer there, right, which is really problematic and challenging for so many reasons. But I think that we are just seeing a rise in people of color being incarcerated. And I think that if you don't have access to bail or lawyer or whatever, the other thing that I found when I was working in the jail, and this is less of my work with behind bars, but when I was working in the jail, plea bargaining is such a thing, right? And people don't really understand, I wouldn't understand, the terms of a plea bargain and what that means. And so people will, they get scared, and so they'll plea out, and they'll plead guilty to things that perhaps they didn't do because they're so afraid of going to through a trial and getting something so much worse. And we want to get these things done. We want to get them through, but plea bargaining and can be really problematic in terms of sentencing, what people are actually getting sentenced for. But I have to be honest, let me be honest with you and tell you that I honestly cannot say why I think, and I think that's sort of why my answer just now felt less authentic. I don't think I can tell you why more women of color are being arrested now than they were. I don't know why that's happening, but I know that it is happening. And I think that trans women of color in particular are profiled. I mean, trans women of color are profiled. They must be doing something wrong because they're walking on the street, you know? And I think that for sure, they by far face higher rates of incarceration and also higher rates of all other kinds of
definitely
problems, right? Abuses and...
Yeah, your word, like the profiling issue, I remember... hearing about the case of a black trans woman. I think her name was Rose or Rosa or something. She was like walking to her job at a lawyer's office. I think she was like a legal worker, and she got arrested for solicitation just by like, because she was walking on the streets while being black and trans.
Yep. That's what they call it. They call it walking while trans.
Yeah, definitely. I really liked that quote because I thought that it really highlighted the group's very fierce seeming dedication to intersectionalities and uncovering, you know, white supremacy and institutional racism in this issue. And it goes super, super deep. So yeah, I wanted to bring that up in this interview just because of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think we need to be absolutely aware of white supremacy and institutional racism and how so firmly they're embedded, especially in our criminal industrial complex, right? Like it's insane. One thing I will say that we've tried to do and are doing actually is we have people who are currently incarcerated on our board of directors, and we have people who are trans. We want to have representation, right? Based on all of these different identities, and that are people that are able to contribute to our organization so that we can keep growing it in the best way that we know how. We want people who are currently incarcerated because they're coming from a different perspective. We actually just recently hired someone that was currently incarcerated, and we do, quote unquote, privilege hiring people who have been incarcerated because they know what it's like. And oftentimes it's harder for them if they have a record to get jobs. And we don't have a lot of money to hire people. This is a very small part-time job, but it's, you know, it is something, and we definitely prioritize that.
That's what's up. So we've talked about a lot of topics pertaining to like this and related issues. How can people support you and the work that you do? Can people donate to Swap Behind Bars if they want to, or how best to support?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're a 501c3, so you absolutely can donate. And I think there's a donate button on our website. The other thing that's been really great is mail is a really big thing in prison, because if you don't have anyone on the outside who is sending mail or putting money on your books or whatever, you know, it sends a message, well, to the person, but also to the people around you that you know, there's really no one on the outside that is looking out for you or thinking about you. And so mail also, it's just a connection with the outside. And so we started this pen pal program. We call it Mentors by Mail because the jail and prisons don't like the word pen pal, but for it's a long story.
I bet.
It's a long story. It's complicated. I can explain. But so we call it Mentors by Mail because historically, let me just say this, and I guess it is relevant and important. Historically, pen pals have been things that where the women will have someone set up outside, like an online pen pal situation, but it's very much for like a sexual or interpersonal relationship. And that pen pal has that connotation in the prison. So like they'll say, I'm 5'3", I'm 100 and whatever pounds, I have long brown hair, I really like this. That's not what we're doing. That's not what we're doing. So we changed it to Mentors by Mail, would you like to get a letter from someone outside? And so we have a ton of sex workers. I believe we have more pen pals than we do people that want pen pals. This is totally fine because they can write multiple people, right? And so anyway, we have pen pals. So that's something if people want to actually get involved at that level, that's really great. We also have Amazon wish lists for whoever wants one. And so we create Amazon wish lists for everybody that requests them. And we ask them specifically, what are you into? And so they'll say, I like dogs, or I want something that's, you know, related to addiction and rehabilitation, or I like urban romance is a big thing. I don't know, right? And so you can go to Amazon wish list and you can buy a book for them and send it for them. And that's huge because, you know, a lot of people have a lot of time. So there's those kind of things. I'm trying to think. We always are looking for people who might want to volunteer. We have a lot of administrative tasks. And you don't have to be physically located with us because we have, you know, brought on volunteers all over.
Yeah.
So
that's awesome. And can people access like the Mentors by Mail list via your website?
Yeah. So basically all they would have to do is send an email to swapbehindbars@gmail.com and say, I want to be a mentor I want to be a pen pal or a mentor. And then we have a form that we send them back so that they can, we try to, if possible, even match people up a little bit. We have such a big numbers now that's harder. In the early days, we had fewer, so we tried to match them up with interest. But I don't run the pen pal thing. Allison and another person largely runs that. So, but yeah, absolutely. They can just send us an email.
That's really, really great. How can people keep updated with the work that you're doing and the work that Swap Behind Bars is doing?
Well, I think that our website is probably the best way. We're continually one other thing that we have done is we've offered scholarships, which they have a paralegal correspondence course that you can complete in 2 years. And so every December 17th, which is the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers, we have granted, people will apply, people that are in prison, you have to have your GED, you have to have 2 years and less than your sentence. People will apply for this paralegal so that you actually now are a paralegal when you're out. And that is great. You know, you can go become a paralegal. So that's another thing that we've been doing. And sometimes people will donate just to that project. Like, I want to donate to that paralegal project, right? And so, but in terms of keeping up with us, I would say our website, and we have had in the past people who would write, Melanie Dante in particular, would write blogs for us about what's going on, we don't often, I mean, we are really incredibly small. There's like 4, 5, 6 of us that are working on this, and we're really just trying to deal with getting the mail and doing all of this stuff, right? So it can be hard. So I think that our website, we need to do, a better job now that we've got it, of putting stuff up. We present. In fact, we're going to be presenting at the International Harm Reduction Conference in Portugal in April. So we present at different conferences around the world. And so, obviously, I don't expect your listeners to go to Portugal to find out what we're doing. But I think the website would probably be the best. Oh, and the Facebook page. By far, now that I'm thinking, the Facebook page and Twitter. And see, those aren't my primary areas, but I think there's so much more going on with Facebook in terms of events and things that we advocate and articles and stuff like that. So Facebook and Twitter. And Alex is responsible for our Twitter feed, and she seems like she's on there all the time. I just don't know how people do that. But I think that one thing I would like to say is that we're really open to feedback. And we're open to suggestions. And so if people hear the show and they want to give us feedback, by all means, you can send us an email at slotbehindbars@gmail.com. If people think, I mean, I'm not saying everyone should start complaining about what we do, but, you know, if you think you have an idea for something that could be helpful, or, you know, you might want to think about this, I just think it's really important to be open to hearing from all kinds of people, and different people have different suggestions. One of the things that we also like to do is we try to get people who have been previously incarcerated to present, to go to conferences, present. And that can be challenging given workloads and families and all of that kind of stuff. But we want people that are in the forefront who have experienced this directly, right? I have never been incarcerated. Alex has been. So we are, you know, we're very open about that, but we want people to, so I'm just open to all different kinds of suggestions and ideas is what I'm saying.
That's super rad. And I think that, like, highlighting the voices of people who've been incarcerated is super, super important because of also, like, the isolating nature of prison and, you know, state incarceration and stuff like that. So.
Yes. And the isolation of, once you leave prison, right, and isolation of having a criminal record and having trouble, you know, getting housing and getting a job. And that's one of the things that we do is we give them, we send them a package when they get released, and we try to, if they have access to social media, we try to hit them on Facebook to say, look, you have a community out here as well. And some of our pen pals have actually continue to communicate when they've been released, and they continue that and then become friends. And so the goal is to continue that relationship after you've been released.
Yeah.
Which is really important.
That's super, super great. Yeah. And we've also spoken on the show about, like, the importance of pen pals, or in this case, like, mentorships via the mail. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's a really important thing to highlight, which we'll also, like, highlight in the show notes.
Cool.
Thank you so much. This was really excellent. It was excellent to get to talk to you about this, and I really admire the work that you're doing, and thank you for your time and all of the things that you do.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for doing the podcast. I mean, that's really great. You know, you're bringing these issues to light, which is really important. So,
I appreciate that. Thanks. Are there ways that people can find you on social media? Do you want to plug your own social media on this?
Oh, yeah. You can find me on Facebook. Dr. Jill McCracken is my Facebook page. And I have a website as well, drjillmccracken.com, I think, which I'm trying to do better about, I'm hoping to post this thing there. You know,
nice.
like this is what I'm doing
yes.
and all that stuff. But.
Cool. Mamaku, mamasama, kumakusa,
mamaku, mamasama, kumakusa, mamaku. If you care to support The Final Straw Radio, please consider a one-time donation via our PayPal, or a recurring donation via our Patreon or LibrePay. We have items on the Patreon and in our Big Cartel web store to thank supporters, including stickers, buttons, t-shirts, and zines. We never charge for our audio work. So if you feel like you can kick something back cash-wise our way, we really appreciate it. Find out more at our website by clicking the support button.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM-LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email if you end up using any content. If you care to, you can send us letters at our new address, which is The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.